also interested in mathematical issues in the social sciences, ranging from psychology to economics and to voting. At the time of Mr. Bush's election, he gave a very interesting analysis at MSRI of how funny things can happen in the voting process. He's also interested in mathematical education and is a member of the Mathematical Sciences Education Board of the National Research Council and in international collaborations. He's just retiring as chair of a committee on which I served, the committee of the U.S. National Committee of the International Mathematical Union. Along with these broad interests goes a broad sense of humor. When I told him what I was going to say in introducing him, his remark was, "I wonder what I'm going to do when I grow up." All this makes Don a wonderful spokesman for mathematics, and I'm delighted that he's just joined MSRI's Board of Trustees and hope to work with him in that role. Don is going to speak to us today on the chaotic evolution of the Newtonian universe. That's a kind of contradiction in terms, in which I'm sure he'll tell us. Please join me in welcoming Don Sari.
Participate in this important event. And indeed, the importance of this new organization really derives from the fact that this has to be one of the most exciting times in all of history to be a mathematician and to be doing mathematics. Part of the reason goes beyond mathematics as a language, because for many of us here, mathematics is a way of thinking. And actually, for many of us, it's a way of living. And as a result, mathematics has expanded in many different directions. Expansion is incredible. It's more than the universe expansion that I'll be talking about in a few minutes. In fact, what we have seen is we've seen major problems that have been around for centuries, and we've seen them fall down, finally solved. That's due to all of the exciting new types of mathematics we're using. And I brought up this right here. If you look on the back, it says here, mathematics is everywhere. This is something that mathematicians indeed are well aware of. And in fact, mathematicians are moving in various areas. We heard about the symbiotic relationship that's starting to be developed in economics and mathematics. I'm involved in another aspect of it. And I think mathematics is moving in many different directions. Actually, you look at it, it's an exciting, exciting time to be a mathematician. What I want to do is I want to talk about one of my first loves, academic loves. I don't want to talk about the others. And really, I want to talk about the chaotic evolution of Newton's universe. Now, when you think about this problem right here in terms of, you know, the expanding universe and things like this, well, surely this has to be one of the oldest problems around. I mean, you can just imagine a caveman coming out and looking up at the stars and trying to figure out what's going on, and the navigators and those doing the star charts for the kings and queens and various other type things. In fact, I stated that this area of the evolution of the universe really is the world's oldest profession. But I found out there was something else, and I hope you don't mind, but I think that since the world's oldest profession, I was told, involved barter, I think the world's oldest is economics. So anyway, I'll be talking about the world's second oldest profession. And in fact, my interest in this started out when I was in fourth grade. In fourth grade, I was in the class, and we were hearing the story about poor Galileo and about having to recant all of his stories and everything else of this type. And I was listening, and I was impressed that, you know, that instead of everything going, the sun going around the earth goes around the sun. But then I asked the following question: what difference does it make? So I asked the teacher, what difference does it make? And she said, And then she said, because that's the way it is. We went on. And it took me a long time, actually, before I was able to find it. I want to a little bit share that, because I'm willing to bet most of us here really don't know. And so let me quickly outline that, because it really tells us some of the symbiotic relationship between mathematics and the physical sciences. Let me start off. Here we have Earth. Earth is, that's called one astronomical unit. So that's one AU, the distance from the Earth, from the Sun, and it takes 1 year to go all the way around. The Mars is 1.5 astronomical units away, more precisely about 1.6. Okay, so let's take 1.5. And Mars takes 2 years to make its round trip. Now, to get rid of fractions, I'm going to, instead of having three halves here, I'm going to have two halves here. I'm going to ignore the denominator. In other words, what I'm going to do is I'm going to work in half astronomical units. And so when we have these half astronomical units, what we have then is that the equations are right here. We have that the equations of the Earth, well, here is 2 for the radius, and then here is just how long it takes. It takes 1 year to get around, and here it is for Mars. And I was told to have a general audience talk, so let me just write that equation down. And let me simply state that what we're interested in is what does it look like? What does Mars look like relative to the Earth? I mean, really, if we want to find out, what difference does it make? Who cares if the Earth goes around the Sun or the Sun goes around the Earth? We want to find out what happens. What does Mars look like relative to the Earth? And so I want to find the equation of this red line right here. And that's just really subtracting these two right here. Nothing more than that. Aha, that would do it greatly, wouldn't it? Okay. So when you go through the equations, what you do is you get an equation of this type right here. And let me tell you what the solution is. The solution is quite nice. What happens is Mars starts off and it starts going around the Earth, as we would expect it. You can't see through my shoulder? I tried to give a transparent way. And what happens is Mars goes around. All right, let me go this way. Let me go this way. How's this? I'll change hands. There we go. Mars starts off right here. What it does is it goes around the Earth, keeps going. It looks quite a ways away. That's when we're on the opposite side of the Sun. It starts rotating in toward the Earth. It comes near the Earth, starts falling near the Earth, gets real close here. Might be election year because it just decides to change its mind and goes around. So in other words, the orbit of Mars relative to the Earth has this loop in here. And in fact, if you go out at the appropriate time when Mars is at its closest to the Earth, you can actually see that by watching over several nights, seeing how Mars does this and has this loop. And if we go farther out, much further out, and look at the other planets, Saturn, Jupiter, etc., what you're going to do is you're going to get loops like this. You're going to get loops like this. Okay? You're going to get loops like that. Now, really what the point on this, one of the points I'm stating here, is that a mathematically very simple thing, just change of coordinates, can have an absolutely profound impact on science as it has in mathematical astronomy. It's significant. Let me give you one other area where a very simple mathematical contribution that all the mathematicians here know about, but how it has significantly affected the space agencies. Now, if you have a... Is that okay, David? if you have a hairy ring, okay, what you can do is you can comb it. You can comb it so it's nice and flat. But if you have a hairy billiard ball, or if you're someone that's not like me, has hair all the way around, no matter how you try to comb it, you're going to have a colic. But the mathematicians, all of us mathematicians know that if you go into a higher dimensional space, and now you look at a billiard ball there, in a four-dimensional space, you can comb it in three different ways, all the way around. Now, I can see a non-mathematician looking at this and saying, wow, what are the mathematicians up to now? I mean, really, who cares? Okay. The space agency cares a lot. And the reason the space agency cares a lot, it's that what they had is that if the world were flat and we would only talk about rings, we could take the equations of motion for following the orbit of a satellite and significantly simplify it. But if we then go, and this was discovered by Levi Civita, the Italian geometer, but if we now try to go to a higher dimensions of the real world, of three-dimensional space, Levi Civita tried his whole career to find the same extension and could not do so. So really what we now know is let's go into the four-dimensional space, let's find the equation, and bring back the solution. And what this does is gives us incredible savings, money-wise, time-wise, accuracy, in terms of following the orbit of the planet or of a spacecraft, etc. And so what we have then is, again, the problem that somewhat simple mathematical, a lot of us mathematicians take for granted, have very profound impact. Let me go on back to that story. Remember I told you about how Mars goes like this? What I did is I took a rotating change of coordinates. I made a change. Let's look at another one. Mercury. Before we used to believe, until 1965, we used to believe that it took 90 days for Mercury to circle the sun, and it took 90 days for the sun to rotate on its axis. If that were correct, then as true in all the astronomy books prior to 1965, we would say that Mercury would have this endless day. The same face of Mercury would always face the sun. But with radar, in 1965, they discover that, no, it takes 60 days to rotate on its axis, and when you go through the mathematics of 60 days, etc., that really a Mercury day is 2 Mercury years long. So the question might be, now Mercury isn't a perfect circle, it has quite an ellipse. And the question might be, if I lived on Mercury, what would it look like when I see the sun come up in the morning? So we could go through the same exercise I just did and ask that question. And what you get is fascinating. What you get is that the sun plays a role much like me. What it does, it gets up in the morning and it says, oh no, I'm going to go back to bed. Okay. Goes back to bed for a while and then it gets up for that long, 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 long day. Until it sets. And when it sets, it's like me, oh, I need another drink of water. It gets up for a short period of time and goes all the way around like this. One of the points that it's with these drawings, these two drawings I have here, it's that something we take as simple gives us, you know, the orbits, the planets are coming in, and everything else, that simple equations can have a fairly complicated reaction if we look at them in a different way. And I'm going to come back to that in about 2 slides from now. But again, what I have here, it's that here is what we have if we believe the Earth is the center of the solar system. Here is what we would have if we believe the sun is the center of the solar system. So how did the ancient astronomers handle this? And this gets to another point I want to make about mathematics, and that is they were very clever. Now, scientific theory, as much as we would like to argue that it's not the case, scientific theory is based on 2 things, the prejudice of the time and the prejudice of the time. And what was the prejudice of the time right around the turn, right around the time of Ptolemy? Well, the prejudice was absolutely captured by the sense of Aristotle. And here we knew that virtue is circular motion, uniform circular motion. So this is uniform circular motion. And we also knew that the heavens were virtuous. And we also knew that the Earth is the center of the solar system. So now I've got to explain those wiggles and those waggles and all those other type things in terms of these principles. And really what the idea of Ptolemy, which was a clever one, an absolutely clever one, is he stated, okay, here I have that uniform motion of that point going around in a circle. But he said, that point does not tell me where the planet is. What that point tells me is the center of another circle that's spinning in uniform motion. And that tells me where the motion is. Now, if you think about this, you see the genius of the whole thing. Because how did I tell you about that wiggle and all those motions inside here? The way I showed you that wiggle is I transform one circular motion to another. And really what Ptolemy does is it just captures exactly just going the inverse story of what I just told. Now, not only that, but we discovered that it wasn't good enough, that that point was not accurate enough for horoscopes and all these other type things. And so what does this mean? This meant that this was, that we would put then another revolving circle. And if that's not accurate enough, we would put another revolving circle. I mean, just think, this became the source of an infinite number of PhD theses. Now, what we now know is with Newton's equations and everything else about how this approach is silly. It's absolutely silly. Or is it? What we now know is that the motion, it has things called almost periodic motion, etc. And what is almost periodic motion? Here's a geometric version of it. In fact, that's a geometric representation of Fourier series. What we have is, which is all through the mathematical physical sciences. And what we have here then is, again, the universality of mathematics, of how ideas keep resurfacing, how the ideas and the importance of ideas keep resurfacing and keep playing roles and important roles in a large number of different areas. But what we then did is we moved on to Newton and his equations. And what Newton did is he came up with his equation that mass times A, that's the acceleration on a particle, is really the mass times acceleration. This just depends on, much like if you have two magnets, how close the two planets are to each other. The closer, the harder they pull each other. And what we have is drives the direction. So here are the famous inverse square law of Newton. What Newton did is he solved the inverse square law, the two-body problem. For the two-body problem, what he did is he had an equation right here that shows that the velocity of the particle is related to the position of the particle. And let's see if we can come up with a description of this. Really, it's the following. It's that if I bounce this, I get nowhere. If I bounce this right here, it'll go to a certain height. If I give it more velocity, it's going to go higher. And Newton's equations capture a relationship between the velocity and the current location. They're bounded by a constant. If this constant is bounded, if it's negative, rather, then the motion has to be bounded. Then the motion has to be bounded. The motion has to be bounded. And that's clear. It just simply says your velocity isn't too heavy, and so therefore the particle is not going to get too high. You also see that, just by common sense, that if you keep hitting this, giving it more velocity, look at systems with more velocities, the particle is going to go out further and further and further. Until we reach a bifurcation point, where this point right here just goes off to infinity. So we have parabolic motion for the mathematicians. The escape is going to be t to the 2/3 power. But all we need from here is that the escape is going to be such that the particles, the velocity of the particle, really wants to come back, but it just can't. It keeps going. So the terminal velocity is zero. It'll never get to that terminal velocity because it's going on forever. But it's really slowing down. And what we then have is the third case, if I hit that ball even harder, and it's hyperbolic, where I have a positive terminal velocity. So really the evolution of the two-body system, and what a naked universe, huh? What a naked universe. You got the sun and the earth and no stars, no planets, nothing. What a naked universe. But for the two-body problem, either the motion is bounded, or if it starts with a bigger bang, then the one particle is going to escape. And I don't know if you're going to put a bet on it or not, but it's going to escape, and it does. Or if you really give it a big bang first starting, it's going to shoot off, and much, much faster. It'll expand off forever to infinity. What Newton did then is decided to look at the three-body problem. Now, the three-body problem is still a fairly naked universe, because the three-body problem is really something like the sun, the earth, and the moon, precisely the problem he looked at. And he said it gave him a headache. And it's been giving mathematicians a headache ever since. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult. In fact, I think this is one of the reasons, if I have my history correct, why Newton moved out and moved into other areas. What happens then is that problem was around for a long time until there were rumors that maybe it was possible to solve it. And here we come into a person by the name of Metag Lefer. And what did Metag Lefer do is Metag Lefer had what? Metag Lefer had a new journal at the end of the 19th century, a new journal to promote. Now, you don't have internet. You don't have advertising. So how are you going to promote a journal? It's pretty clear. What you do is you set up a prize and try to get the world's best mathematician, Poincaré, to try to solve it. And people will then pay attention. Prizes are important. And what happens is that, and I'm just going to give you a very, very short one here, description on here, and I'll give you a reference, is that Poincaré thought he solved the problem. He thought he solved a version of the three-body problem. He did not. There was a serious error in that problem. And it went on and on and on until what he had to do is admit he had an error, go through the expense of buying back all those journals, giving a new solution, and paying for the new journal, which was about 50% more than the prize. And the prize was, I don't know, about a year's salary or something, or maybe a year and a half salary. What he did is in the other paper is essentially why I couldn't solve the three-body problem. You know, what did I do for summer? Why I couldn't solve the three-body problem. And that paper probably is more important than if he had solved the three-body problem. That is where chaos, the chaotic dynamics that we see in so many different areas today, that's where chaotic dynamics was founded. And that's where chaotic dynamics came from. So quite frankly, this is something which goes in all sorts of areas, from stirring of paint, mixing, all sorts of different areas of the sciences. A very delightful paper, or book rather, is written by Diaco and Holmes, in Princeton University Press. It's a general public book, and it gives this story, and Florin is right up here in the audience, so I have the advantage of trying to embarrass him. But it's a delightful book. All right, so we couldn't solve the three-body problem. Now what are we going to do? Well, it took until the 1920s. And then in the 1920s, a French mathematician by the name of Chazy, he started looking at it and saying, well, look, I can't solve the three-body problem. But maybe I can at least find the evolution of the three-body problem. How does the three-body problem look like as time goes to infinity? And he made a simple assumption. He said that suppose the radius of the universe expands to infinity as time goes to infinity. From that, by use of mathematics, he was able to prove that the three-body problem breaks down into two-body problems. The first two-body problem, the little red one, the line right there, okay, there we have it. And the second one comes from the center of mass of that first system to the third particle. And in a masterful piece of work, which is definitely does not get the credit and attention it should, what he was able to then show is that under this situation then, both two-body problems behave like two-body problems. So now we can go back to what we know about a two-body problem and just fill in the blanks. We can say, this is bounded. That's bounded. Remember, that was one of the two-body classifications. And then add a classification for here. Parabolic. Okay. Or bounded hyperbolic. In both cases, what you do is you have an ellipse that's going around and another particle just ejected. One is just barely ejected, and the other it's moved off like a bat out of a hot place. Okay? And then what you do is you just go to the next statement. All right. Suppose this right here is parabolic. Okay, well, then this one might be parabolic and it might be hyperbolic, and you just fill in all of the situations. Notice, bounded is not here. The reason bounded is not here is because his assumption is that if the radius of the universe goes to infinity. And so the question then becomes, what if the radius of the universe doesn't go to infinity? Well, that surely sounds like it's bounded. Well, not really. What you might have is you might have the system where the part of this expansion goes out a certain ways. No, it changes its mind and comes in. Goes out a little bit further, comes in, and is bounded. And it just keeps oscillating like this. So you have an oscillating effect. And so the question is could we have oscillatory-type motion? Is it possible for the three-body problem, for this model of the universe, not to have one of these well-behaved, but a nice oscillation effect? And what he did is he spent the rest of his career trying to show that it cannot exist. Or if it does exist, it's insignificant. It exists. It exists. In fact, this was proved by the Russian mathematician Sitnikov. Let's do a thought experiment here. Suppose we have right here and here are two bodies. And they're rotating, and they're a fixed distance apart. Remember, that's the only gravity. Now I put a particle of zero mass right here. So what's the acceleration on this particle? Well, inverse square, it's called close it is to these particles. Closer it is, the stronger the pull. Farther away, the weaker the pull. So what does this mean? These two are rotating. So really, the pull on this particle only depends on how high it is above this projector. So what this means is that the motion always will be periodic. Up at a certain height, comes down, it picks up that acceleration, it passes through here. Now it's got a braking effect, pulling it the other direction. And it's the same braking effect, so the motion is just going to be periodic. going to be just periodic. What happens then, is what Sitnikov said, is that, okay, let's make this not into a circle, but let's make that into an ellipse. Let's make that into an ellipse. Now think about what the experiment is. At this height, the pull on this thing depends not just on how high it is, but on how close the particles are to each other. If they're close to each other, it's going to be one hell of a pull, much more than if they were further apart. So now we have a timing device, a timing problem, where if I'm at this motion right here, and it's on this side of the plane, right when there's a big tug, it's coming down pretty fast. But if it gets through the other side, when they're expanding, it doesn't have as much, a braking effect is going to go a bit further. And then it's going to come back, and if you get the timing right, so there's a lot of mathematics here, if you get the timing right just when it comes back and gets an extra tug, and then a relaxation, and you're going to get that particle oscillating up and down. And so he proved the existence of the motion. And Alexeyev then looked at there and said, wow, there's got to be some interesting mathematics in there. So he went through and extracted what is known as the Russian school, Markov process approach, towards chaotic dynamics. And so again, the chaos really comes not from what you have read in popular books, but the chaos really comes in terms of computer simulations, etc. It really comes from the mathematics. And it comes from the mathematics of an area that has been long studied in mathematics and in history. Now, see what the mechanism is to get that chaotic behavior? The mechanism is oscillations, and at certain times you get expansion, and other times you don't. You get relaxation. And what we see from this motion right here is that from this motion is that if we have an expansion, okay, what's that expansion? It's when the two big suns get close to each other, and they're going to drag this thing down harder. And recurrence, where motion comes back. Remember the earlier pictures I showed you? The earlier pictures of such as this one right here, etc. What we have in these pictures, and this has to be something that's involved with all of the planets, what we have is a certain amount of recurrence. Planets are going around. And clearly a certain amount of expansion. Particles closer, stronger pull. So what we must expect is we must expect to discover chaotic behavior in the n-body problem. And indeed, we see a lot of it. In fact, we see a lot of it in this oscillatory motion. I showed that that any speed you want it to have, an expansion, can't go as fast as this parabolic, but any other speed, like taking forever, you know, like watching the pot boiling, takes forever to boil. Well, what happens is forever for these things to start getting up. Anything you want, there exists a Cantor set of initial conditions which give you all of these behaviors. So what we have then is a reasonably nice picture of the evolution of the universe in this very, very barren universe consisting of three particles. Well, when I started looking at this, I said, I can't do the three-body problem. I can't do the four-body problem. But it sounds sexier to say you can't do the n-body problem. So I started looking at the n-body problem to see what happens. And then in subsequent work with Christian Marshall and I, we ended up with a story about the evolution of any n-body system. There are two parts to the story. The first part to the story is that the distance between any two particles we were able to prove really behaves like that bounded or that oscillatory motion that I told you about earlier. So I might have three particles over here, and they might have an oscillation effect or something weird. Or they might expand parabolically, slowly expanding, looking like it's going to never make it, it's going to come back, but it does. And then going off like that bat, very fast. And from here, if you go through this picture and fill in the lines, what you have is the following. Take a particle. Now find all particles that are nearby. Nearby in this sense right here. Call that a galaxy. Next, find a particle which separates this bead. And find all of its particles which are nearby. And keep doing this. And what you end up with is a cluster of galaxies. Okay? Then what you do is take a look at a particle that separates much further, much faster. Maybe it's over here. And now what you do is you play that same game and you see how the clusters of galaxies are separating from each other. Okay. So what we have then is with the use of mathematical tools is we have a nice outline of the overall sketch of how the universe has to evolve. And what we also know is that from observation, that is what we observe. That's precisely what we observe. We have our galaxies. We have clusters of galaxies. The astronomers have used very, very imaginative terms. The cluster of galaxy we live in, you know, the local ones, is called a local group. But there are other clusters of galaxies, and this is how they evolve from each other. Notice the nice pictures I have, nice regularity. We show that indeed that has to happen too. It's that if you have three clusters of galaxies, or three galaxies in your cluster, they have to form either an equilateral triangle or a nice straight line configuration, depending on the masses. And if you have four of them, you have to have something else which is a central configuration, maybe a square or various others, but it's not haphazard. They're truly well-defined configurations, a lot of stability in this kind of picture. And how do the clusters of galaxies expand? Well, that is very different. But what you do is you get very, very different pictures than what we have, you know, a question of, well, if all, remember the story you heard when you were first taking that Astronomy 101 about if all of the stars were out there, why isn't it light at dark? And, you know, why isn't it light all the time? And the answer is because you wait till nighttime or something. What happens is, I was just at a conference in astrodynamics, and the people from NASA and that were there, and they were talking about their space mission to the sun. And someone asked, what do you mean you're going to the sun? You know, he says, it's very easy. We're going to go at night. But what we have is, by use of mathematics, is we are now getting a picture which is quite nice about what's going on. And this holds for just about any of the natural force laws or perturbations or Einsteinian relativity added to it, etc. This is the solution. But as true always in mathematics, you have a solution, and then you always have that or. You have that other thing. Mathematics is very complex. And the other solution we have is or the diameter of the universe divided by your favorite function. For mathematicians, what's your favorite function? I know most of you like e to the t, or maybe e to the e to the e to the t. Okay, that the diameter of the universe expands faster than time, that the n-body problem will emit solution that thumbs its nose at relativity, because the speeds will fast exceed the speed of light. From a pragmatic perspective, this solution right here is not of interest. From a mathematical interest, this is of great interest. And so, after I discovered this, I then spent several years following the lead of Shazi, trying to show that it doesn't exist. Like Shazi found the oscillatory motion marred his beauty of his solution. I felt this marred it. But it does. And this was shown by Jeff Shaw and me. And it uses some beautiful work by Dick McGeehee, and then McGeehee and John Mather. Now, let me just try to give an intuition for this. Yeah, I've got time. Let me give an intuition for this. A collision behaves like this right here. Well, an elastic one would come up to an exact height. Okay. Now, remember that experiment when you were in high school? You got a basketball and you got a tennis ball. And you went up to the third floor and you tried to drop them out. And you see, what happens is the following. It's that if I could do this, and I'm not, because I'll never find the two balls again, and I don't have very many super balls. If I did this and I did it just right, in a timing just right, see, when it hits the floor, it's moving pretty fast. And that would come and hit this one with an elastic collision. But that elastic collision would be much like Barry Bonds hitting a baseball. It would fly. So just like in that experiment in high school, if you took and you did it right with the basketball and the tennis ball, it bounced down there, and the tennis ball went up higher. I never could get it to work. I spent the next 2 days trying to find more balls. But that's the way you're supposed to, and you can do this in a glass ball. Well, this is precisely what happens here on the four-body problem. You got two particles, and if they're colliding, right here, if they're colliding, and if a third particle hits there soon enough, at the right timing, it's hitting there right when one of those particles is being expelled from a collision. So that's like really clobbering it, and so it shoots out very fast. If it shoots out very fast, it's going to go forever. So what you need is you need a break, a fourth body. It'll hit that fourth body, rebound, and come back in again. And so what we have then is Mather and McGeehee use this for one type of behavior. What Jeff and I did is we looked at this problem and had to use a couple of tricks, stable-unstable manifold-type tricks, to show that this particle could come down slow enough. Slow enough that it'll take forever for this expansion, for this to come down, get hit, run off, hit the other particle, come back down, hit it, and go off again. And to make it go off so that it can exceed any time you want. And we show, by use of chaotic type dynamics, that indeed what we have is that there is something called a Cantor set of initial conditions for the four-body, five-body, etc. body problems. This behaves. So what is it that we have? For me, mathematics, whether I'm looking at some of my new interests in economics or some of these others in these other areas, mathematics is actually not a language, but it really is a way of thinking. It's a way of life. And I think that the rewards which society is starting to get from these various mathematical endeavors, and the fact that mathematics is everywhere, and mathematicians know it, and mathematicians are beginning to look everywhere on these type things, I think the rewards are incredible. So we're gathering here for the opening ceremonies for this institute. And as I stated earlier, I think that this is an incredibly important event. So with that, I thank you very much.